Hello and welcome to WS Podcast. My name is Wojciech Salski. I'll be your host for today. And before we begin, may I just remind you, if you find this podcast entertaining, useful, if you feel like it's something worth sharing with the world, worth listening to, then please make sure to follow, subscribe, you know, on whichever platform you may be encountering this, so you don't miss any other episode. And if you'd like to share it with the world by maybe sharing it on social media or something, that would be wonderful. I feel like that's the best kind of advertisement. So yeah, really, I appreciate all of you who are. I appreciate all the emails, and I'm truly grateful for all of the encounters even that I've had. Even recently, I've recorded an episode with a gentleman whom you've by now either listened to or will listen in the upcoming weeks. And it was a really lovely coincidence, or to be honest, I don't know. I've not asked him yet how did he come around to reach out. And yeah, these are some wonderful coincidences and little miracles that happen. So I appreciate all of you who are listening. I'm really excited to start a new season for you. My wife decided today that the new season will be about geopolitics, finance, books about the world, about the economy, about progress. Of course, you know, as you know, in all the other episodes about different books, there is always a bit of everything, and I'm not gonna spoil too much of the fun. Ultimately, I would encourage you to read the books or to listen to them in audible form once you get your hands on them. But in the meantime, if you'd like to grasp a few pieces of information, I've prepared some notes for you again. Today we're going to discuss The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth. And we'll just go from there. Over the next 10 weeks, you'll see 9 more weeks, you'll see a bunch of other books related to, yeah, as I said, geopolitics, economy, finance, the world as well. And each time I will try to tie them together with some other episodes we've done. And so over time you can sort of get a broader perspective, right? So I hope the quality of the sound is okay. I'm still learning, still experimenting in this new space, which is much different. I hope the light is better today than it was last week. Please let me know in the comments if that's not the case, or if it is, just as a reassuring gesture. And yeah, I've got my tea. Everything's switched off. It's the evening. I don't think anyone's going to be bothering me at this point. And so let's begin. So I'd like to talk with you today about The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth. And the main thesis of the book, which in and of itself is quite revolutionary, although it seemingly points to something very obvious, to something that we've been simply conditioned to believe it's not the case, or we've never thought about it to get a chance to think about it. It points to this idea that all progress is deflationary. Now, of course, before we go in deeper, I want to remind you of what deflation and inflation is, right? If you remember from the other episodes, whether about the Bitcoin standard, or whether about the creature from Jekyll Island, all of the other finance-focused, economy-focused books we've explored, inflation is essentially growing in size of something, right? You inflate a balloon, so you fill it with more air. In the same way, you're experiencing inflation every day, if you notice it, of course. When you observe that prices of things that you buy on the daily basis over time become higher, in the nominal value of your currency. Let's say that, I don't know, your parents, when they went to school, they would spend, let's say, 50 cents to buy a pint of milk. Now, a pint of milk is probably somewhere around £2. That change in the value is inflation, and it's the inflation of the currency. It's not that milk became more expensive because someone invented a different, you know, milk that is so superb to that previous one. Rather, over time, your money, your currency, is losing value. It's losing purchasing power, right? So this is the inflation part. To the contrary of that is deflation. Deflation is basically de-inflation, right? So if you blew up a balloon and it's nice and big, when you start letting the air out, you're deflating it. In the same way, a currency, for example, can be deflated by burning, literally, sometimes, physically, or by, you know, changing the numbers on a spreadsheet, by taking out some amount of the money in the circulation, and so, in a way, tightening that supply, right? So a deflation is very visible in technology fields, and this is actually where Jeff Booth starts. He says that progress is inherently deflationary. What does that mean? If you notice, even in your own life, and you know, no matter what age you are at this point, you can see that a price of an average technological good, such as a smartphone, for example, over time seems to drop. So, of course, don't get me wrong, some phones are still expensive, but imagine how expensive it was to have a mobile phone 20 years ago for an average citizen in comparison to how expensive it is right now. Almost everyone nowadays has a smartphone of some sort. I'm not saying that companies are not taking maybe advantage of their prestige and charging premium for the brand, but inherently a computer, a phone, a car, all these technological devices over time become more affordable, more popular, right? A TV used to be a luxury. Now a TV, while it might still be considered a luxury in a developing country, somewhere where people are really, really poor, it's fairly ubiquitous. Almost, I would expect basically 99% of all of you who are listening to this episode to have a TV of a sort in your house. It has become a ubiquitous thing. And, you know, of course, with the ways the market works, a free market, mind you, where there is competition, those that produce cheaper and better win, right? And depending on the different strategies of the competition on the market, and this is going slightly maybe off topic towards economic basis and some fundamental ideas, but essentially there are many strategies on how to act as a market agent. One of them is to charge less than your competition. One of them is to become better at providing more efficient service, and so you cut costs while providing the service cheaper for the client. One is to be that premium provider that everyone knows has quality products, and on that quality you can charge a premium, so a price above an average market price. But in a natural state of economy, one that is not manipulated by anyone, Jeff Booth states this greatest thesis, I guess, of the book, which is that in a natural state of economy, it's deflation that takes place. So a natural state of economy is deflationary, not inflationary. And let me reiterate, it stems from the fact that over time, progress, as inherently deflationary, will allow us to produce better, more efficiently. And if there is a free market, the choices that people will make, and so the votes that they will cast on different creators, on different companies, will bring out the winner, and the winners will be those who produce the most efficient, the best products at the lowest possible price, right? And of course, you as an average consumer of any product will benefit from this competition by being able to buy cheaper products of a better or similar quality, okay? Now, let me pause here for a moment and just ask yourself and ponder this. Do you feel like that's the case in your country right now? I mean, do you feel like the prices are falling and you can buy more for less, and you can buy better product for less money? Or is it the other way around? Well, you know, unless you're one of the few, and I really don't think there are that many, and I, off the top of my head, I can't even pinpoint one. Unless you are in this wonderful situation where that really is the case, I would assume that you're, as well as myself, are living in an economy which somehow, for whatever reasons, and we're not going to analyze them fully here, I'm going to just give you some takes on this. It seems like the prices are rising, right? You pay more today than you paid a year ago. Your money is worth less today than it was a year ago. And what this essentially stems from is inflation. It's the inflation of your money, of your currency, that allows for this phenomena to happen. So even though inherently, if we're going forward, if we assume that there is progress happening, we should be getting more for less and better for cheaper price, somehow we don't. And Jeff Booth answers this conundrum by pointing out that it's the governments and central banks that will do almost anything to stop deflation. They even have it as part of their mandates. If you look up the idea of central bank, and if you look up your local central bank, whether you're in the United States and they call themselves the Federal Reserve Bank, which of course is the the bank described in The Creature from Jekyll Island, whether you're gonna look upon the European Central Bank, or maybe IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, or the BIS, which is the Bank for International Settlements, which is sort of like a bank for central banks. Almost every country in the world right now has a central bank, which is closely collaborating, cooperating, sometimes seemingly opposing, but for the most part walking to the same tune with the government, in essentially aiming to inflate the currency. And the stated goal is often around 2% per year. Now think about it. Why would someone have a goal of inflating your currency, which means essentially devaluing, taking away some of its value, year on year by 2%? And it's stated as a goal. Now, of course, it's because from their perspective, it's something good. inflation in the Keynesian economics, which if you want to look it up, is the economics that has been taught to us for over the past almost 100 years now. In Keynesian economics, this idea of inflation being positive because it promotes economic growth, it promotes progress, is at the root of this strategy to always inflate. And of course, what they aim to do is inflate steadily. They don't want to overinflate. Because as you can imagine, you know, if you blow up a balloon too much, it might burst, right? Which is essentially what happens when a market goes bust, when an economic crisis becomes so problematic, when a currency is so devalued that it goes into hyperinflation and basically begins its death spiral, right? And that's, you know, many people even nowadays are living in countries where that is the case, or that was recently the case, where suddenly you might leave your work at, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, and by the time your paycheck lands in your hand on Monday, the money you've earned is already split in half. You can buy half as much as you could have on Friday simply by the inflation being so rampant, right? Now, just to visualize it, Jeff Booth offers us some statistics. And mind you that the book goes up to 2018, which is why 2018 is the date here. So the year 2000 is the first statistics, and it says in the year 2000, the total debt of the world, so all the total debt in all the central banks, all the banks, you know, accounted for, total economic debt was $62 trillion, and total world GDP, which is gross domestic product, which is supposedly a measure of the economy's growth and prosperity, was $33.5 trillion, right? So $62 trillion and $33.5 trillion. 18 years later, in 2018, total debt was $237 trillion, while total world GDP stayed at $80 trillion. So observe here, we've gone in 18 years, and this is before COVID, mind you, which obviously just exacerbated this debt incurring by the governments and by the world, really. Total debt grew over 4 times. At the same time, the world GDP grew only twice, slightly over 2 times. So we're growing, even if this was just to stay that way without all the crises and all the other things that you might want to dig deeper into and observe just how much, for example, how much debt was incurred by printing throughout COVID, you know, to cover all the subsidies and support, social support for everyone, seemingly. Obviously, if you're doing any of your finances, you know that growing twice as fast with your debt than you do with your growth in your account, you're doomed to fail, right? It's basically, if you think about it, an insanity to be allowing that to happen. But of course, it's for a reason, right? And this is what Jeff Booth tries to explore. And of course, one of the premise here is that they want to stay ahead of deflation. And think about it this way. If technology accelerates deflation, because everything becomes cheaper the moment a robot can do what a human did. A computer can calculate much faster than anyone ever could. You know, even myself as an accountant, I don't remember the times when accountants had to calculate everything on a calculator or maybe even on a pen and paper. Now, majority of calculations that we do at work on the daily basis can be done with an AI assistant or at least with an online calculation sheet that saves so much effort, saves so much time, right? And we're obviously paid for time in a day job. So if technology is accelerating deflation, it's probably understandable why they have to accelerate inflation to stay ahead of deflation, right? Because those are opposing forces. And it is not my place to say why that's the case. And I don't want to, you know, I would like you to explore that for yourself. I'll put links below to other books, and maybe later on in the series, in this season, we might dive a little bit deeper into what could be the reason for incurring so much debt and how does that debt affect our daily lives. The one thing that I've stated already and I'll state it again is inflation essentially robs you of the value of your money, right? Which is why they say that savers are losers. Because if you understand that your money is being devalued, you have to come up with ways to keep that value of that money going forward, which is exactly, I think, why the title of the book is Price of Tomorrow. What is the price of tomorrow for you today? What will you have today? What will you have tomorrow if you save today? And, you know, there are some calculations that you can do, which are not that difficult, that allow you to see just how much money, even according to the inflation of 2% per year, over time will that cost you. It's a compounding effect. It's the same way as the other way around. If you save and invest over time, as we've explored in Let's Talk About Money, over time, saving and investing allows you to compound the interest on that saving and investing, right? But of course, we're talking here about saving in a way that allows for compounding, not only putting it in your shoe or on your account balance. Now, according to Jeff Booth, by 2018, paying back the debt that we've just explored, which was $237 trillion, would take us, I mean the world, 1,000 years. Of course, I mean, it's an absurd amount, right? For that to to even be paid off, and if we're accelerating twice at the speed with debt creation than we do with creation of productivity and efficiency, then we have no chance of catching up with it. Which of course begs the question: do they ever want to pay it off? And personally, I don't think they do. The quote here is: It is usually the case that the experts expect the world to continue in the fashion it used to before, until they are proven wrong and are no longer the experts. Now, I've included this quote because it basically sets up the second point of our discussion today, which is about thinking of the future, the strategy. But it, I'd like you at this point to just open your mind a little bit. And whatever you've been taught, whether in your academic studies, maybe you've been taught, like myself, some accounting, maybe you've been to economy classes, maybe you've not had any of that. I'd like you to just explore this paradigm shift. And let me remind you, first of all, the natural state of economy is deflation. Now, in our current economy, it seems like the natural state is inflation. And the paradigm shift here that must occur for you to start sort of seeing eye to eye with what Jeff offers us is this idea that it is not normal for everything to go up in price over time. It is not normal, and it's not okay, and even though if you're benefiting from it, it is not okay in the fundamental sense that your house, that your, you know, assets that you might hold, some sort of bonds, some sort of gold, silver, and all that, it is not normal that they are going up in price. It's because the currency in which they are measured for their price is losing, it's weakening, it's being devalued, it's inflating, and that's not normal. And if you, you know, imagine you had a bucket full of water and you were carrying a water across the desert. What would you do if you realized that you have a hole in your bucket and the water is slowly but surely spilling out and, you know, disappearing into the sand, never to be retrieved? Of course, you would do all you can to cover that hole, right? To not lose more water, you might not be able to do exactly that with the economy. You know, we're all just people here. It's not like I'm changing right now the policy of the world to fix the economy, but we should look at it from the perspective of it is not okay and it is not benefiting us in the slightest to accept this as a normal, natural state. A natural state of the economy is deflation, because progress is deflationary. A quote here: if our future prosperity depends on continued debt growth, how is our economy different from a Ponzi scheme? Now, if you know, Ponzi scheme is basically a situation, and it comes from the let me just pull it up, information for you, so I don't butcher the name. It comes from Charles Ponzi, who ran a famous scam in 1920s. Basically, the guy promised huge profits from a postal sort of reply coupons. Like an old version of stock market kind of investments. And he would pay people, he would pay from the money that he got from new people joining the scheme, he would pay money to the people that joined before. And he would say that that's the profit from the investment, even though there was never any profit. He was just moving the money from the new suckers, essentially, to the old suckers. So he would sort of pretend that there is some sort of progress and some sort of movement taking place. So it's like a pyramid scheme, they call it, right? So whoever joins at the bottom gives away their money for the benefit of those who are above him, who came before him. Now, what this quote mentions here is, of course, that if our future prosperity depends on incurring more debt, then essentially that means that we are in a Ponzi scheme, because debt is an obligation of the future. If you go in debt, and maybe some of you are in debt, maybe for your university or for a mortgage or for a loan, whatever. If you go in debt, you're basically you're borrowing from the future, because you've already taken this money that you don't have just yet. You take it at an interest, and the interest is the money paid for that transaction to take place. And you borrow from the future and you promise to pay it back from the future. But if we do it on a societal scale, then essentially what that means is our kids or the kids of our kids or their kids' kids' kids we'll have to pay back what we've borrowed to use right now. Because, and this is the key point, if you remember instant gratification versus delayed gratification, whenever you take on debt, you're playing in the field of instant gratification, right? So you choose to consume for whatever purpose now, and you take a loan from the future. You borrow from the future. Whenever you save and invest and let your money, you know, be put in some assets that will appreciate over time, because we know that inflation will happen, you're actually, instead of borrowing from the future, you're giving yourself towards the future. You're delaying your gratification. You don't consume right now. You save, and then in the future, you can reap the benefits of that saving / investing, right? But of course, you know, it begs a question, if this is the case, that we're constantly being devalued, and if your money is worth tomorrow less than it's worth today, why would you save? And that's a very valid question. Unfortunately, it is exactly the kind of question that people potentially, from my perspective, sort of subconsciously, just refuse to even ask themselves. And they just live from paycheck to paycheck without realizing what's the problem and accepting that it's going to be worse anyway. So why not am I going to just party today like there is no tomorrow? Because if you think about it, if your future seems worse than today, then it almost feels like there is no tomorrow, right? It's a very, very sad perspective to have. If you have no hope that tomorrow will be better than today, why wouldn't you party today like there is no tomorrow? And essentially, that's unfortunately what takes place in our day and age for most people, as they unwillingly participate in this debt-based Ponzi scheme. They, you know, we're being taxed on the money that we earn for our time. And then as we save that money so we can have better time in the future, that money gets taxed again without our awareness through inflation. And so we're being double taxed or triple taxed. Essentially, really, we're being stolen from. You know, this is not an argument against taxes. I guess we could have a discussion whether or not taxes are useful and to what degree. But in terms of inflation, no one benefits from inflation other than those that create money, right? Whoever is the closest to the money printer is the beneficiary of inflation. Everyone else who is earning money in any way, shape, or form, over time, if they save in that money, they are the ones being taken from, right? They are being stolen from. And that happens to us on the daily basis. It's the same basically everywhere. You know, whether in UK or in Poland, prices today are higher than they were 10 years ago. When I came here, it was cheaper. When I was in Poland, when I was a youngster, it was cheaper than it is today. And it's not because things have gotten so much better. It's because the money has been devalued so much. Now, the thinking strategy that Jeff invites us to consider is that in times of great change, keeping a beginner's mind is an advantage. Jeff invites us really to have, and this is really lovely, you should have strong opinions weakly held, right? So if you stand by something, you should have a strong opinion on it, but you should hold it weakly. You should be, you should have this beginner's mindset, like we've explored with Rami on the episode. I'll actually take a note here. Sorry, there is a ambulance going past. I'll just write it down. Rami episode, yeah. I'll put it in the link below. A wonderful conversation with my friend from Jiu-Jitsu about beginner's mindset. We should have strong opinions weakly held. We should hold a beginner's mindset, which basically, I guess, could be explained by saying, keep an open mind and assume that you don't know, and that's okay. Ask questions, listen intently, actively observe, learn from mistakes of others and of yours, and educate yourself. This is the key message, really, that I'd like you to have from this podcast as well. Educate yourself. Really get curious about things that you don't know if you want to know about them. Don't ask everyone around you. Just do it yourself. Pick up a book. Maybe go online and really dive deeply into it and figure out for yourself. Have some opinions, but weakly held, right? Now, Jeff actually mentions Jeff Bezos's apparently attitude, a question that apparently drives his attitude to business, which is, what's not going to change in the next 10 years? And this is a really wonderful question to ask yourself. Of course, if you're coming up with some business ideas, or if you're coming up with what's going to happen in the future, then for me, what stood out in this question and in this chapter, in this part of the book, was that everything will change. Almost everything. But there will be some things that might not change just yet, or might not change so drastically. And Bezos's attitude, of course, as a strategy for the future, is to figure out what will not change in the next 10 years, and in those areas, invest and develop and, you know, sort of put your energy there. And those things that will change, or you don't know whether or not they will change, they will probably change then. Just be more wary of them, right? Don't put so much weight in those areas. Now, of course, another quote here from Jeff, and mind you, he is a very intellectual, very, from my perspective, very abstractly thinking gentleman. Diverse reading and learning helps us to recognize patterns and spot opportunities. Jeff suggests that you should learn about many different things. You should be open for different topics and ideas. It seems to me that in the age where many very specific, very, you know, sort of learning heavy jobs will become either automatized or at least enhanced by the use of LLMs, you know, large language models and some sort of technology. It's actually better for both your career, your business opportunities, your aspirations for the future, to dabble in different things, to learn about areas that you're interested in, to become more observant. Even by just learning a little bit about everything, you might, as Jeff pointed out here, you might observe some patterns that will allow you to interact with the world in a better, more efficient, more skillful manner, right? And two quotes from Karl Popper, which must have been, I don't remember now at which point in the book they were, but I've written both of them, and they really sort of, I think, hit the nail on the head with this idea of attitude of beginner's mindset and learning. Quote number one is, all of our knowledge grows only from continually learning from our mistakes. And the second one, true ignorance is not the absence of knowledge, it's the refusal to acquire it. And this one really struck me, you know. Willful blindness is what comes to mind. And not to dive too deeply into it, but it seems to me, and I would like you, you know, since you're listening to this, you're one of them, so I think you are, I am preaching to the choir in a sense, but I would like you to encourage your loved ones and yourself and others around you whenever you have a chance to have a deeply meaningful conversation with them, to explore topics for yourself, to dive deeper into subjects, to read on stuff that interests you, not to stop only at the surface of a TikTok video or a, you know, 15-minute short. I don't think you're listening to this and you've gotten this far by having such attitude, but I can imagine that many people around you do. And I see it myself as well. And, you know, in many ways, I think these are such curious, such interesting, such amazing times, and also such, turbulent, really, if depending on your perspective. And from my perspective, in my opinion, which is strong but weakly held, prove me wrong, it seems to me that it will pay off immensely for your future and the future of your family, the future of your friends, the future of your kids, if you are going to have some or you already do. It will be immensely valuable to learn to think for yourself, because in the more and more algorithmically designed world where everything seems to try to, you know, catch your attention and guide it in a certain direction, those who learn on themselves, on their own, those who learn from mistakes rather than, you know, just mindlessly scroll, will be in advantage. And I'm not talking about competition with one another. I'm talking about being in advantage with your life, in your life, being better prepared at opportunity when it comes, being better prepared at a risky situation when it comes. You know, Ray Dalio has this amazing quote that we've mentioned on the podcast before. If you worry, you don't have to worry. If you don't worry, you have to worry. In other words, if you think now about the future, and if you plan accordingly, and if you put in place some sort of guardrails to keep you afloat, and if you save, if you invest, if you think about your, you know, monetary policy for your house, your financial health, your mental health, your physical health, all of these will pay off in the future and you will be better prepared, and so you will not have to worry about them later. It's this instant gratification versus delayed gratification. And of course, if you've not caught it just yet, I'm inviting you to always practice delayed gratification. Apart from the times when you're actually celebrating and enjoying the moment because of that moment that you've been preparing for, whatever that is, unless you're present in the moment, try your best to always have this delayed gratification in mind and think in the long term. What would Wojtek from the future benefit from Wojtek from today, and not the other way around? Don't take a debt from your future unless you really, really need to. Rather, invest in that future so it's brighter and nicer and you're more hopeful and you have a very different attitude then. Now, the third topic that I'll briefly touch on and then sort of wrap it up is about these attitudes for the future. And, you know, of course, now the question for us is, what should we do about it? Since we should keep an open mind, and since we know that inflation is not necessarily for our best benefit, and deflation is how the world should be, what can we do about it? And according to Jeff, there is a bunch of theories that play a role in figuring out how the world will look like. And of course, the major realpolitik theory is the game theory, which basically is like a field of study that analyzes what the opponent might do, and through that lens you can sort of observe the world and understand how people and countries and states and organizations act. Then you have the prisoner's dilemma, which is the a scenario where a classic game theory scenario where two individuals may choose to cooperate or betray one another, and even though cooperation benefits both, rational self-interest often leads them to betray, and then both of them get the worst outcome, right? Because if both of them stay silent, then both are okay. But if one of them stays silent and the other one isn't and starts talking, then the one that stayed silent will lose. And so you assume that the other will talk, and so you also talk, and both of you are, put in prison. And then there is this situation of zero-sum game and non-zero-sum game. And this one is really critical, and Jeff takes some proper time to explore this. I'm just going to take a little sip of my tea, which is already almost cold. So a zero-sum game is essentially a situation, a situation on the market or a situation in a fight where one participant's win is the other one's loss. For example, let's say that we have one cup of tea and there is two of us fighting for it. Whoever wins that cup of tea wins the whole cup of tea, and so he gets the sum of the tea, and the other one stays with zero. No tea for the loser. So a zero-sum game, of course, puts us in whatever scenario it might be, puts those different participants in an adversary relationship. You look at the other person, if you are in a fight with them, you look at the other person as your adversary, right? You don't wish them too well, let's say, at least for the duration of the fight. In terms of a societal situation or a worldwide situation, if we do live in a zero-sum game, so a winner-takes-all game, then we are inherently adversary to one another. And of course, you can imagine, and I'm afraid that in many ways we are living in that kind of world right now in many ways, unless on a international sort of level, you can imagine that it's not the most beneficial as a cooperation enhancing situation, right? If my win comes only from you losing, then we cannot cooperate. There is no space to cooperate. Of course, the alternative is a non-zero-sum game. So a game in which if both participants play a certain way, there is an opportunity for a win-win situation, right? Or at least win and not lose situation. And I guess on this point, the invitation and sort of the whole of the analysis of the book, and I guess I should mention it since we've gotten this far, is that according to Jeff, it all stems from the majority of these problems stem from this inflation, right? From the inflation and the devaluation of the money, which is our sort of means of exchange and store of value and all of that. And to fix it, there is a saying that, I guess it's a phrase that, has been popularized through the Bitcoin movement: fix the money, fix the world. If you fix the system of financial monetary policy and all of that, you might be able to change this zero-sum game, which we seem to be playing right now, since, you know, if someone is printing more money, then I am the one losing if I have that money. If we can change it into a system where someone winning more doesn't mean I'm losing what I've already amassed, what I already have, at least not lose, because there's also an option potentially for me to gain from it, then the world might be a better place. And of course, it can also become much closer to an utopia of a sort in terms of our ability to live on, comfortably. If deflation became truly a natural state of economy, if progress could truly be pushing that deflation rather than central banks and governments fighting the deflation by inflating our currency more and more, maybe our world would be different, and maybe we would be benefiting from cheaper prices, better quality products and all of that. And of course, there are many rabbit holes to dive deep into there. One of them would be, how would a quality of a product change if the money wasn't inflated? And it seems like, at least from my perspective, the quality of the product would have to rise, because we would be back at this healthy competition of whoever creates better earns more than that one who creates worse. And so everyone is incentivized to create better. Now, because of inflation, it seems like many companies might be incentivized not to create better, simply to create cheaper. And then we get fast food, right? Which, of course, is very cheap and also very, very unhealthy for you. So this is where hard money versus weak money comes into play. And hard money is essentially money that cannot be devalued as easily as weak money. From the standpoint of this inflation, weak money is your currency, right? It's being inflated, and even though they might tell you that the inflation rate is, 5% or even less in the last few years, I have no doubt it's more. At least the shelf at the shop tells me it's more. Let's assume that it's 5%. So your pound is devalued by 5% each year. And so 100 pounds this year will buy you 95 pounds worth of money, worth of products next year. Gold could be considered a harder money because it's more difficult to print gold. You have to literally dig it up. And on average, the supply of gold kept basically the same, apart from a few gold rushes here and there, on average at 2% year on year. And so the inflation rate of gold is about 2%. So just by moving your savings into gold, you can benefit from a lower inflation, right? Because £100 worth of gold today will buy you a £98 worth of gold next year. Of course, we're not accounting for the fact that inflation will eat away at the dollars in which gold is valued faster. And so, you know, it becomes this conundrum when, for the sake of being able to comprehend it, an average Joe like myself has to consider everything in terms of dollars or pounds or zlotys, right? But truth be told, that's not really a good yardstick if it keeps changing, right? We just don't have a better one yet. And of course, Jeff Booth is a big proponent of Bitcoin. And as you've heard on the episode about Bitcoin on this episode, on this podcast, or maybe you've watched one of the Bitcoin shows that I've suggested you do, Bitcoin is not inflationary. It's inherently deflationary. because there is a limited supply. And although right now, of course, each year more Bitcoin is being mined, and so there is a slight inflation taking place, it's a minuscule one. It's really, really tiny. Majority of Bitcoin has already been mined to date. And since the supply is finite, it's totally limited. We know that over time, the same amount of Bitcoin will at least stay the same and even potentially become more valuable, because remember that some people might lose their Bitcoin. Maybe Bitcoin will gain in comparison to other less strong, less hard money assets. And then you have this, you know, money go up technology, essentially, how people get first attracted to Bitcoin. Of course, as you know from my episodes, and not only mine, Bitcoin is more than that, and I would encourage you to dive deeper into it. But for the sake of the argument right now, I'm just going to finish on this Gresham law. Gresham's law basically states that hard money will always take the value from good money, weak money. So good money always runs away from bad money, essentially. So whichever asset is harder, whichever money is harder, it will gain in value over time at the expense of the weaker asset. And this is what you see with the prices of real estate, for example. I bet you've heard your parents or your friends say that real estate is a great investment. Why is it a great investment? Because the money through which that real estate is being priced is inflating at such a rate that even though your house, which is being used, mind you, so it's not like it's better in a better condition after 2 months of living in it than as new, somehow over those 2 months might gain in value. And of course, it's not because the house became better, it's because the money became worse. And that's essentially Gresham's law. One side, so the bad money, will go always and be siphoned into good side, the good money, over time, simply because money will seek refuge in the asset, in a money that it allows it to stay there energetically healthier, right? To be kept there. But this, we're going slightly too far with this. Now, my final remark is this one. I think if there is one book of this season to read, it is for a reason that this is the first book of the season, and I would encourage you to jump on that bandwagon. Maybe you're still motivated by the early months, early weeks even of the year. Get ahead and start reading. Bitcoin is on a discount right now as well. If you know, you know. If you don't, get yourself educated. It's worth it. It's worth your time, I promise you. The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth. Personally, in my opinion, it's a compulsory read for anyone out there right now, young or old, who's interested in figuring out how to deal with this world, which seems to be changing at such a rapid pace, and how to make sure that financially you're going to be sound in the future. In terms of the invitation for you this week, apart from, of course, maybe reading or listening to the book, I would encourage you to really play this game with, you know, with Jeff, as he invites us to, and look at the world through this lens that the natural state of economy is deflationary. Notice how the price of the technology that surrounds you is going down over time, even though they still seem to be expensive. Notice how many things you have in your house that your mom or your grandma could not even wish to afford at the time, and now they are very ubiquitous and they are just there. Even if they are quite pricey, you can afford them, you being an average Joe like myself. just ponder this and maybe discuss it with a friend or a family member or your loved one. Start shifting your paradigm. It takes some time. I'm not there yet. I'm still mind blown whenever I hear Jeff Booth's interview online, and I'd love to pick the man's brain. Hopefully at some point in the future, I'll get a chance to at least shake his hand. Maybe even interview him. Who knows what the future holds. But essentially, start changing your paradigm. Open your mind to this idea that the economic situation in which we're living is not natural, is man-made, and it can be fixed. And even if it cannot be fixed by you, you can fix your situation by understanding how it affects you and acting accordingly. And I think that's what wisdom is: knowing what to do, when to do it, and how. And so I encourage you to do so, to dig deep and figure things out. Other than that, yet again, if you've gotten this far, please make sure to follow or subscribe. It really does make a difference. And I appreciate your time, your attention, all your love. And, you know, basically, you're giving me the most valuable thing in your life, which is your time. So I appreciate that. And I hope that me giving that to you was a worthy gesture. And yeah, there are some exciting things ahead. I'm not going to spoil that just yet. Let's see what happens. For the time being, have a wonderful, wonderful week. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I'll see you next time.